Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Steve Austin Show is brought to you free today by our friends at BetOnline. Get in the mix at betonline.ag and use the promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
A couple of shows ago, I told you guys that it's been about 8 years since I've read a book. And then I read a book on Bob Probert, the hockey player for the Detroit Red Wings. I was about to take a trip, and because I had gained so much momentum from that one book, I knew that I needed to keep that going. So I had a couple of books on my bookshelf, and there was a book in particular that came out in 2005. I've had the book since 2006, and I've never read it. And the book was Terry Funk, More Than Just Hardcore. This thing has been sitting on my damn bookshelf forever, and I said, man, this is a prime time to read this thing. So I took it on my trip with me from L.A. to Houston, kept reading it, Houston back to L.A., finished it just yesterday. I've been bragging about this book because it hit home with me on so many levels, coming from the business of pro wrestling. And I told anybody that's a true fan of the business that they need to go out and buy this book, because that's how important I think this book is. For any of you cats, whether you're a guy or a gal trying to get into the business of professional wrestling, you need to read More Than Just Hardcore, because it's stories about the business. It's what the business is about. It's about the respect for the business, the love for the business, and Terry Funk has spent a lifetime in the business. There's life lessons in here. It's just an up and down thing that takes you on a hell of a ride. There's several spots in here where there's just laugh out loud stuff. And it just hit me right in my core, and I said back then, I gotta have Terry Funk on the show. So without any further ado, I got Terry Funk on the show. Terry, thank you so much for being here on the Steve Austin Show. Welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Steve. Thank you very much for introduction that I probably didn't even deserve. I sound like a hell of a guy there.
Well, I know there's
I try to be.
A pretty salty human being when you're in the ring. And, you know, Terry, when I was reading your book, you know, you come from Amarillo. Your dad was a professional wrestler. He was a promoter. And Dory Jr. came along. And then you came along. It's a lifelong career. Your whole life has been in the wrestling business. But I don't want to start right from the beginning. I want to jump right into something that's been on my mind ever since the day it happened. And as I was reading the book, I was like, holy shit, I was there on this occasion. I want to take you back to ECW, the ECW arena, right there in Philadelphia, that little wonderful shithole building with great atmosphere. It was my first night in the territory. I was healing up from a triceps injury. Eric Bischoff shit canned me. Paul Lee gives me a call. I show up. It's you and Mick Foley in the ring. There's a flaming branding iron, and then there's a flaming chair. And the next thing I know, there's a fan burning at ringside on the front row. And I'm thinking, what the fuck did I get myself into?
I got sued. Mick came out of the dressing room, to my surprise, with a flaming chair. I don't know where he got the damn thing, but it was flaming. It had 3-foot flames on it. He ran around the ring, came into the ring, hit me with the damn chair. I was burning up. I rolled out of the ring. He threw the chair at me, and somehow I got sued, and I was the one that was in trouble that had to go up there. I think the guy sued us for like $20 million.
So what happened out of it?
We went ahead and lied our way out of it, I guess. They found us not guilty. We lied that, sorry, son of a bitch, didn't get a nickel.
God dang, man. I was thinking to myself.
He's got burns for life, folks.
Man, it was my first night in the territory. I needed the money. I'd been fired. You know, gone was that guaranteed check from WCW. I roll in, and all of a sudden I'm thinking, man, what in the hell is going on here? People are going to burn up in flames and die. I said, this promotion is going under ASAP. What am I going to do for my next job?
Oh, gosh, I'll tell you what. You know, but at that time, though, as we had to make a name for ourselves, there was no television. It was all done by word of mouth. And by word of mouth, we pretty much crossed the country.
How was it in those, how long were you actually in ECW?
I was there from the very, if you want to know who started the thing, it was myself and Eddie Gilbert. And I think his name was Todd Gordon.
Yeah.
And it was Todd. And Todd had some bucks that he wanted to put into the business. And Eddie and I flew up there and met with him in Philly and opened up our first show. And when we had the first show, there was about 300 people there. But it was better than nothing, you know. And the show absolutely stunk. And I went out there that night, and I told them, I said, you people, just bear with us, have some patience, and we're going to do a lot better than we did tonight. And sure enough, we did, week after week. And finally, it got, extremely popular up in that area. Then Heyman came along, Paul Heyman, and he did a good job, too, did a good job of promotion.
So Paul wasn't initially in the mix. It was you, Eddie Gilbert, and Todd Gordon.
No. We were...
And that was still Eastern Championship Wrestling, correct?
Yeah, we were scratching then.
So when did the Extreme name change come about? And whose idea was that?
I don't know. It kind of came about as the fans themselves created that name. Now, you're going to hear some people created it for that, but that's not true. The fans themselves created ECW. They called it Extreme Championship Wrestling. Paulie or one of the promoters picked up on the idea of it and went with the ECW because it was ECW. It was Eastern Championship Wrestling to start with Todd Gordon, and they just changed the Eastern to Extreme. And they changed it after they saw a few matches like myself burning up and a few things like that. Calling for chairs in the ring and having 250, 300 chairs thrown into the ring. Just some crazy stuff. But it had to be that way.
Now, was it that way every week? Was it that way every week? Because I remember y'all got that machine rolling. I was busy on the road doing a different gig, and I didn't have time to catch all the TV. And then I started catching it, but I was catching it from, I was way a few months behind, and it was absolutely insane. And I mean that as in a good way. There was so much energy, so much enthusiasm. Everybody had their balls on the line going for it. The promos were coming out of that place were off the charts. The work in the ring, everybody was giving it everything they had. Was it everybody bonding together right off the get-go, or was it after that stinkeroo that first night and you got the promo and say this thing's going to get better? What lit a fire underneath that promotion to say, hey, let's turn this motherfucker around?
Just by the process of elimination, and the process of elimination was how do you exist? You better be better than anything else that's on television. And if you can be better and more exciting and more dynamic, well, then you've got a chance. And that's what we knew we had to be, And we had a great camaraderie among the guys that we weren't going to, we were going to go down in a flame if we went down. And that's the way we all kind of looked at it.
Was it all for one, one for all mentality?
Absolutely. And it was a wonderful mentality, you know.
Hey, let me ask you something, Terry.
You know, that's the most wonderful thing about it, you know. And Cactus came in up there, you know, and he was a great entity into the thing, you know. But I don't know if you, you know, whenever I was at the WrestleManias, I introduced Cactus, you know, and I don't know if you listened to my introduction or not. But it was very much about what a wrestler should be.
Right.
What I feel a wrestler should be, what Steve Austin thinks that a wrestler should be. What, you know, and I'm not claiming to be one of the great ones, but the ones that really have the love for the wrestling business know that it's the wrestler in the ring is who it's all about, whose face is covered in blood, sweat, dust, and dirt. He's the wrestler that does the best, not only for himself, but for his opponent. And most of all, for you, the fans, that have given up your hard-earned cash to see something special.
Let's continue that note there and talking about someone putting it all on the line for the promotion, for the paying customer, for the rest of the locker room. And we're going to talk more with Terry Funk right after this.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
How do you banish high rates on your car insurance? You switch to GEICO during GEICO-ween. October is our favorite time of the year. And the folks over at GEICO have been working even harder to cast out high rates and craft just the right policy for you and your family. Switching to GEICO isn't so scary, especially when they could brew up spellbinding savings just for you. So get a quote today at GEICO.com and see just how much you could save. No eye of the newt needed. Happy GEICO-ween, everybody.
Okay, coming back in, we're talking about Mick Foley and people putting everything on the line, you know, for the fans that are paying that hard-earned money, and for the other guys in the locker room who are trying to further the cause. So that attitude, is that around today?
I definitely think it is. It's not among every guy, but it's among most of the guys, you know, and they are hand-picking them so much, you know. But it's so hard for an individual to come up anymore, you know. But there are, you know, WWE has got some great guys. Gerald Briscoe does a great job of shaking out the bushes, you know. And he shakes those bushes out there and looks for those guys, and he finds them. And WWE school, now it's in Orlando, not in Tampa anymore. But they do a great job, too, you know. And we have got, you know, Steve, I've said this before, but what is professional wrestling? It was a pure shoot in 1905.
Right.
And it was Total Entertainment. It had been announced at Total Entertainment in 2010.
Right.
Well, if you stretch a line along that, we all evolve somewhere along the line. And what we evolved to is what the people wanted us to be, what turned the turnstile. That's what this business is, what the people want it to be, and that's what it always is. It's by their choice what you have in this day and age. It's not by our choice. They dictate to us. And that's the same thing that was happening in ECW. Fans were dictating to the company. They let them know what they wanted to see, and what they were willing to pay for.
You made an interesting note there in talking about the evolution of the business from being a total shoot to a work atmosphere, a work product, and to just being straight up sports entertainment. You know, and then finally Vince goes to the athletic.
What's wrong with that? It's great.
No. But here's my question. My question is this: in that evolution process, there you were before wrestling had come out of the closet, so to speak, and the business was still protected. Then all of a sudden, you've got all the exposés because everybody, even from back in the day, wanted to think and say or imply that it was fake, or just call a spade and say, "Hey, this is fake." And guys were out on the streets. streets fighting to protect their business. Your dad did it. You did it. Dory Jr. did it. So then when you're entrenched and you're trying to protect the business and 2020 comes around and Geraldo Rivera is doing this, his thing, and Dr. D, David Schultz, slaps the hell out of John Stossel and breaks his eardrums to protect the business, what are you thinking while all this is going on? Like, is it, hey, the business is changing, or we got to hang on to what we got and stand our ground?
Hang on and stand your ground. That was always, you know, I mean, that was the way that my father taught me. Hang on and stand your ground. But I knew, you know, I hung on and I stood my ground and I stood my ground and stood it. And finally, as I realized, but I came to the realization, which a lot of other guys didn't do, you know, they wanted to stick with the old style and the old school and this and that. And I went ahead and I made my move up to WWE. And the reason I made it was because I knew that's where it was going. That's where it was going to all, you know, accumulate and come to a peak, was up there. And there wasn't going to be any more. And I knew that. And other guys didn't know it. And a lot of guys, they, you know, a lot of good guys, a lot of my good friends, you know, was went broke in the business. You know, and should that happen, you know, life is life.
Mm.
Life is life, you know, and that's just the way it is.
Well, you know, with telling the people, hey, basically, this is sports entertainment, we're basically saying
greatest thing that ever happened to our business. It was the thing that I was the furthest from my mind.
At the time.
It was the furthest from my brother's mind at that time. It was the greatest thing that he ever did, what Vince McMahon ever did, whenever he said that we are sports entertainment.
If
he didn't do that, there would be no business right now.
And I always got, you know, from when that first happened, I was kind of like, well, at least we're not trying to insult the public's intelligence anymore. Because, you know, all the while back in the evolution, as you protected it, you know, you didn't want to smarten anybody up. And now you're finally saying, okay, it's entertainment, and you can really push the envelope creatively with the different storylines and not insult their intelligence and further bring them closer to the business.
I agree with you 100%.
But with that being said, Terry,
I was on a funny trip, you know, and the trip was I flew up from Florida, and several, I'd say four or five of us flew up. We flew up to, I don't know. It was up there on the East Coast, but Vern Gagne put the show on. It might have been up to Minneapolis. But Eddie flew us up there, and there was myself and Junior and Eddie and a couple of the other boys with us, you know. And we flew up there to partake in that match up there because they were making total tapes to fight Vince. Mm. You know, the territories were. Well, we flew up there, you know, and it was an amazing situation, you know. Eddie Graham was half nuts, you know, and always will be, you know? But he had a great mind for the business, you know, and I think that if he would have lived, I don't know what he would have done. You know, I think he was a dangerous individual.
Hey,
you know, Terry. I think he might have pulled out his weapons, you know, to protect Florida from the takeover that was taking place.
Hey, but let me ask you a quick question about Eddie Graham, because I had his name written down here. I've got so many things that I have written down in different names. But I always heard, and, you know, Eddie Graham ran the Florida territory down there, and I never got a chance to meet the guy. And I heard so many wonderful stories about that Florida territory and how badass it was and the weather, the travel. It was a great territory. And Eddie Graham was always considered such a genius, but in particular with finishes. What was it about Eddie Graham that was so much more forward than everybody else from a promotional standpoint or finish standpoint?
He was brilliant. You know, I'll give you an example of Eddie. Is one night we were going up to Orlando, and he went ahead and he and I discussed a finish that two other guys were going to use that night, you know, and talked about it and everything else. So we got there, and he says, Terry, he says, come on in here and watch this. So he went ahead and he said to the two guys, he said, well, what do you think we should do? And one of them said, well, I think we should do this. And Eddie went ahead and kept them talking, just edging him in there until they finally came up with the same finish that he had discussed with me on the way up there. He was a wonderful, wonderful manipulator. He had a wonderful mind for the business. He truly did. And, you know, as he did a lot of great things, too, you know, as he learned a lot from my father, who learned a lot from a guy by the name of Kel Farley, who was an old-time wrestler here years ago that started Boys Ranch up here in the Amarillo area.
That's when your dad took over, correct?
Wide famous ranch, you know.
Yeah.
And they take underprivileged kids there. But Kel started that place, you know, and my father always preached to Eddie what Kel preached to him. You've got to do good things, Eddie, and my father too, for your community. And you've got to do the right things for the people in the town. You've got to be a good person. And that's what Eddie molded his life after, and my father too molded it after the way Kel lived his. And, you know, that's a very important thing that you're thought of as a good person, you know. And Eddie was a good person. Of course, he was ready to go ahead and fight somebody any chance he got. You know, my dad and him used to, you know, duke it out all the time.
Hey, and, Terry, let's talk about your dad for a second.
Yeah.
He got in the ring. He learned how to wrestle, and he was already a wrestler, but he got into the business of pro wrestling. It was a hard road for him to get in, and then he started promoting. And then as I was reading the book, I never really picked up who broke you into the business or who trained you. Was it indeed your father? Who taught you how to work?
My father trained me. I started up here. I watched it. You know, whenever I was a kid, you know, 4 years old, all the other kids wanted to play cowboys and Indians, you know. And I wanted to wrestle because my father was a wrestler, you know, and I just always, always wanted to be a wrestler all of my life. And, you know, my brother was the same way. We both knew where we were going, you know, but my father, he was a great amateur out of Indiana University. Yep. He won 3 state championships at Hammond High in Hammond, Indiana. And then he got a scholarship to Indiana University. Well, he was there under Billy Tom his first year, made the team, did everything, and the war broke out. So what happened then is he joined up because he was going to be in the Navy, wanted to be, you know, have a bed instead of rolling around in a tent. So he joined the Navy and spent 4 years in it, and he came back. And whenever he came back, he just walked into the Chicago arena, said, I want to be a wrestler. Well, they had a couple of shooters up there, so they said, okay, if you can beat this guy, you can. So he beat that guy. So he came back the next week. They put him in with another guy. He beat that guy. He beat about 5 or 6 of their boys, and they decided to smarten him up. So they smartened him up, you know. So you talk about that kind of heritage that I had in the business, you know, and you wonder why that we thought the way that we did and everything, and we're so set in our ways of staying with, hey, the business is a shoot. Well, you know, it's all of my life at Boys Ranch, you know, and I saw my father go ahead and get guys out on the roof of the school, you know, and there were some trees that were growing up beside it, and guys would knock the business, and he'd say, come on up the roof. They had a mat up there, you know, and he'd beat them up so bad they'd run right off the roof and try to grab the tree limbs. Couldn't really reach them, you know, be about 10 or 12 feet to the ground. They were just wanting to get out of there alive. But, you know, I watched all of this stuff, and I watched Eddie do it with Jack and Jerry, you know, and time after time those guys beat up mark after mark after mark after mark, you know. I did the same thing in Amarillo. My brother did the same thing. Beat up people. That's the way you do it. But if you get one that sticks around, well, they get into the thing. You know, and we started so many great guys out of this area.
But they had an appreciation and respect for the business. And going back to when your dad went into Chicago, he wanted to get in the business. They put him in a ring with a shooter. He whips his ass. Another shooter. He whips his ass. When you say you got two shooters in the ring, and these guys are legitimate, real-deal skills for anybody who don't know what a shooter is. It's someone who can really wrestle, really fight, really do it all. But how far would these guys take it? They put him in a ring. Here comes this new guy, Dory Funk Sr., into that ring with a tried-and-true shooter. How far, Terry, did they let that go?
They let it go all the way. They let it go all the way, and they let it go ahead and go into matches and because he was drawing a crowd. He was from Hammond, and they had it there in Hammond, you know, in Chicago, 6 miles from Hammond, and they'd have the matches, and the old man would go ahead and go in there, and he would win. So he won again. He thought he was doing the right thing. So it went for week after week, and what the only thing he could figure out was to make the guys bleed. That's the only way he could get the crowd up. So he'd cross their face and, you know, elbow them, and it was just a total MMA. He did that time after time. But the old man was tough, and, whenever they had the wrestling war in Houston, I didn't even discuss this, but whenever they had the wrestling war years ago in Houston, you know, Macklemore was down there then. You probably never even heard of that name. But Macklemore was down there and Siegel. But anyhow, as my father went down there and was going to, you know, he was their shooter. You know, and the other ones that were down there was Ray Gunkel. Gunkel, national champion. Ricky Starr, they all went down there, you know, and faced everybody that anybody would send in there.
But check it out, Terry. I got a question for you. I'm all over the board on this thing. So your dad's a shooter.
I hope I'm making sense.
No, you're making total sense. But your dad's a shooter. You can shoot. So can Dory Jr.
Well, I don't know if I can or not, you know.
Not right now, but I'm just saying back in the day, I mean, you were a wrestler's wrestler. You could mat wrestle. You could chain wrestle. You could do it all. So then,
that's why, you know, that's one thing is that they, whenever they would pick a champion, they always wanted one that could handle himself.
Absolutely, I want to get to that. But my point is, and my question, with all these wrestling skills that you, Terry Funk, possess, you start doing moonsaults. I got it on my notes. It says moonsaults. Really?
Absolutely.
What were you? How do you go from a mat technician, brawler, wrestler extraordinaire to the moonsault? What were you thinking? What was the thought process, man?
Bob Armstrong was in the ring at the time. I was wrestling Bob Armstrong down in Tennessee. So I said, Bob, I'm going to come off the top rope on you, and I'm going to do a backflip. I don't know about that, Terry. I said, don't worry about it. I'm going to cover you up with chairs first. So I had about, I threw about 30 chairs on top of him.
Chairs
so
always make a soft landing.
The chairs.
What year was that?
I don't know. I was in my 40s, though.
But what possessed you to go up there and tell Bob Armstrong you're going to do a damn jump off the top turnbuckle on him?
I'm 40 years old. I got to excite the people. So you got to do something. Hell, first time I saw you in the ring, I knew you were going to make it. I knew you was going to make a lot of money, and I went and I talked to you, too.
Where was that at?
I think it was honestly and seriously up there in Philly. I don't know if you were up there or what, but did you wrestle there for ECW one time? I'd been watching you on Dallas, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I knew that you were a great worker. Saw you the first time, you know, and that's a funny thing, is I can pick out guys if they're going to, you know, I mean, I really truly believe I could go ahead and I could walk out there right now and tell you which guy is going to draw money and which guy isn't. And I think that Steve Austin can do exactly the same goddamn thing.
Man, I tell you what, I got a pretty lucky break coming into Dallas with Chris Adams. He saw something in me. They sent me to Tennessee. I worked for about 6 months, starved to death, and they brought me back. I remember when I was working for Jerry Jarrett, and he said, okay, Steve, we're fixing to send you back to Dallas. And I told him, I said, man, I said, you're firing me? He goes, hell no, we're not firing you, Steve. We want to turn you, turn you heel and send you back to work with Chris. So I got lucky to be in a good program with Chris, and Chris is as good as he could be. Could be equally as bad. And he had his issues, but he was a great mentor as far as work in the ring. He always let me keep my heat when I needed it. He always got the win when he needed it. So it was a good platform for me. And, so he helped me out tremendously. But I remember when I was in his school, and this is a story that Mick Foley always tells. Mick was in the business before me, and we were in class, wrestling school, that Saturday morning after the TV taping there at Sportatorium, and we were running the ropes. And Mick always says if there was one guy that was going to make it, it was going to be that guy with the long blonde hair, because he just had something. So Mick kind of picked it out early in the day, too. But anyway, enough about the shit about me. I got lucky. I made it. And now let's talk a little bit about Mick Foley. You guys are the best of friends. You've done some absolutely brutal matches together. And when did you first meet Mick?
Well, I first met him. We were at a national, oh, gosh, let me see. It was NWA from out of Atlanta. And we were down there, it was Dallas Wrestling. And I had seen Mick on a tape. And Mick came down there and came up there. After we had the matches, Mick came up there, and I said, you know, I said, boy, you had a good match, you know, and I said, I knew him, because right. Whenever I see a guy like that, he just instantly struck me as he had a little box, you know, I mean, at that time, you know, he had a little box office in him, you know. I knew that he had box office in him, you know, and that's the same way with you, you know, as I knew that you had box office in you. Another guy that knew that you had box office in you was Rick. Rick always thought the world of your work.
Well, I remember back in the day when I was more of a technical wrestler, before I got dropped on my head and it kind of had changed my style into the brawler, you know, I was kind of considered a little bit of the next Ric Flair, although that comparison could never really be made. Each wrestler is their own person, but... You know, that would be light years away and would never happen. But I remember in your book, one of the things you said about Mick, he came up to you, if you remember this, and he said, well, how was my match? And you told him it was a drizzling shits, or you told him it was a shits. And then you were kind of just fucking with him. But then you actually said, kid, you got potential. I see a lot in you, but you're taking too much of an ass whooping. I mean, yeah, we're plain to see that you can get your ass beat, but you got to be more vicious in the ring. You got to have more
That's
offense.
That's exactly what I told him. That's the exact conversation that I had with him.
I think it was to a point of his hunger and trying to get over. And I say this because there's so many young cats who will be listening to this. So many people trying to find their way. Like I kind of modeled myself early on as kind of a chicken shit heel, kind of in the vein of Ric Flair, which wasn't my forte. It didn't work for me. Here's Mick Foley trying to get noticed, absorbing punishment, but not getting himself over to your point of, hey, this sumbitch can whoop ass too. So there's so many things that go with getting over. And I think when you opened up his eyes to that, that certainly allowed him to turn the corner.
I know that I took him over there to Japan, and I know that, he did a wonderful job over there, you know, and Mick is the epitome of a wrestler, you know what I mean, of a great wrestler. He's not in there to hurt that opponent. He's in there to make his opponent. That's what we all got to remember, you know, and the other thing that we got to remember is the better we make our opponents, it makes you that much better when you beat them.
But, you know, that was one of the things that I always loved about working with Mick, because, man, I had some classic matches with that guy, and it was a very mutual respect. And I was snug in the ring. Everybody knew that. But that's just the way I worked. But total respect for the other cat, and I was never trying to hurt anybody, and I damn sure wasn't a shooter. But my point is, every time I worked with Mick, he put it on the line every single night. It didn't matter if there was 20,000 or 50.
Doesn't
Mick
matter.
Worked his Doesn't ass matter. Off because people paid their money, and that son of a bitch came to perform.
And I think that there truly is a lot of guys that that have that feeling in the business, you know. And unfortunately, some of them are at a different level. But they do have that, you know. There's so many guys that have compassion for our profession that are in it right now. And that's the only reason they're in it, is for the compassion they have for it, you know. And you run into the assholes, too.
Yeah, there's...
You know, that there's always assholes in every business.
Yeah, there is, and these feelings of hunger and trying to satisfy the crowd, I mean, obviously are not exclusive to you, me, or Mick Foley. They're, to your point, yeah, there's a lot of guys out there like that, but to my point, there's also a lot of cats out there that will sandbag when the house isn't what it is. But you mentioned when you took Mick Foley over to Japan, you spent a lot of time over there. First of all...
You know, because...
No, I just wanted to ask you, because there was a lot of guys, you spent a lot of time, Terry, over in Japan. You spent a lot of time in the States. I mean, you were in both systems, entrenched. You were everywhere. But getting over in Japan, it seems to be a little bit different than getting over in the United States. Is there a difference? Because, you know, Dr. Death Steve Williams, as physical and great of a wrestler as he was, in the States, he wasn't over so much. But in Japan, big money. What's the difference?
You know, what they had over there was a style that's a very stiff style. And same style, I've seen you work that way, Steve. I tried to work, you know, I try to be solid and everything else. But they like that stiff style, and they love the wrestling part of it, and Doc could do it. You know, and they love that legitimacy from the past. And Doc had that, you know. It's just like Robinson and so many different guys, you know, that went over there through the years. You know, they...
You're talking about Billy Robinson, right?
Yeah.
Hey, let me ask you a question about him. Would that guy take some liberties in the ring every now and then? I've always heard he was a little bit of a salty individual.
Of course. You're damn right.
A little bit of a mean streak from what I hear.
One of those English goose. Hey, did you know what his kid's doing?
No.
Oh, his kid went to West Point, and now he's down there at Pensacola or something like that, and they've made the entire base after him. It's Base Robinson or something like that.
Really?
Naval. In the Navy, yeah. He's just done wonderfully, and, you know, Billy's doing okay, too.
I want to ask you.
And I like to see that whenever some of our guys are doing all right, the older guys. You know what I really worry about, Steve, and I'm not kidding you, and this is a scary thought, and I'm not trying to point the finger at you know, by saying this guy is that way or that guy is that way or anything else. But, you know, as I go to the Cauliflower Alley Club all the time, and I definitely notice that there's some of us that are having problems in older ages, me included, that, you know, I think that the bumps take their toll.
The bumps do take their toll.
Yeah, on the head.
Absolutely.
You know, the head shots that we take through the years, you know.
Let's talk a little bit about that. The bumps, the grind, and the travel. Let's talk about bumps right now, and then I really want to get into the travel because you have some very interesting things to say about that. But these days are bumps to the head, chair shots.
Yeah, that's my old man told me a long time ago. He says, Terry, he said, don't do that shit. I was wrestling Harley Race in Amarillo in a Texas Death Match. And I got out of chair, and Harley did too. And we tried to beat each other's brains out. And my old man told me, he said, Terry, he said, don't do that crap. He said, one of these days you won't be able to think if you keep on doing that stuff.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, Terry, as you well know,
I'm not thinking very well.
Well, I know, but, you know, to your point, you know, you come from this wonderful background of amateur wrestling, and like a cat like me, who's just a straight-up football player, goes to a professional wrestling school run by Chris Adams, and it was basically learn how to take bumps, protect yourself when you fall, and a couple of wrestling holds, and then, as you know, everything else is on-the-job training. My point is, never... And any professional wrestling school that I know of, do they teach you how to swing a steel chair? So many times you roll into a damn angle, a match, or whatever, your first day in a territory. Oh, you're getting the finish. Bing, bang, boom. You run in with the chair, knock the dog shit out of this guy, do this with that guy. And you're trying to protect the business, but you're trying to protect that guy. But when push comes to shove, you've got to swing that chair, and it's up to them to block it or not block it. So, man, my point is... Chair shots hurt like a motherfucker. I was always one of those guys kind of put up my hands if I seen it coming, but man, they can do a lot of damage.
Absolutely, you know, and it's, you know, as you look at football too, though, you see those linemen getting on that line, defensive and offensive interior linemen. You don't see many of them doing the, you know, doing the commentary for the NFL, do you?
Yeah.
You know, you see those quarterbacks, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're all over the announcers. They hire those guys as announcers. Those linemen, they got them hid somewhere.
Oh, I know. But, you know.
Can't think. Can't remember their name.
It's hard to move around, but, you know, with all the, we're talking about the chair shots and the bumps. I want to go into your first reign as a world champion, NWA world champion, because you traveled so much. But before we do that, and we're talking about these headshots, I'm going to take a little bit of break, and I'm going to come back with Terry Funk, and we're going to talk headaches, hassles, and horse shit on the road to professional wrestling. Be right back.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
You know what's really scary? Seeing just how much you could have been saving on car insurance by switching to GEICO. It's almost as scary as that homemade elf costume your mom made you wear in junior high school. No, GEICO can erase the memory of tripping down the hallway in oversized pointy shoes, but they could save you 15% or more on car insurance. Stop waking up at night in a cold sweat wondering what happened to that green onesie. Just switch to GEICO and save. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Terry, let's go down with right now inventory on your body, the kind of injuries you've sustained, or surgeries, broken bones. How are you? You're still in one piece, probably a lot of duct tape and baling wire.
I'm the real $6 million man. You know, that's why I kept on going back out there and out there to California. Because at the time, nobody covered anything as far as the wrestling business goes. So I'd go out there and get... I think at the time it was 12 or 15 grand or something like that, make that, and I'd have entire insurance in, you know.
You talking about your SAG insurance?
So then I kept on doing that and kept on doing that and kept on going back, and then I go back to wrestling later in the year. So finally I found out I was just a year away from retirement. So I went back out there, and I am a retired artiste. But what I do... is I have had total medical and still do, but I've had not so damn much, you know, and I'm thrilled that I did that, you know, and I would consider myself a genius for doing it.
Well, that's one of the hard things about the business is because, you know, my whole life I never had, you know, this is a straight up deal. I never had any insurance at all. And all of a sudden, I finally get the break. Well, you know, when you're in the ring, you figure if you get hurt, the promoter's going to pay for it. So my whole time, you know, when I finally made it up to WWF and now it's WWE, I never had any insurance. Now, when I got screwed up or blew something out in the ring, the WWF paid for it. But I didn't have any kind of benefits, no insurance. And I finally did a movie in 2007 called The Condemned. And I did, well, yeah, but then I didn't do anything in the next year, so it elapsed. So finally I got back in the game and made another movie. And so my point is, guys like us are so hard and expensive to insure that it's beyond insanity. So now I keep my credits, to your point, like you are, to keep the SAG insurance, because, I mean, it sucks ass. Yes.
Oh, I'll tell you what, it's a great insurance tag is. And they go ahead, I say $6 million man, I've had two knees done, I've had elbows done, I've had so many different operations, I had my guts done, I've had this done, that done, on and on and on. And I don't know, plus my whole family is covered. And that's a wonderful thing too, Steve. My family was covered, but nobody could understand why I'd go out there and work out there in California, and I'd go ahead and get above that amount that I had to make that in the year's time, and then I would have the entire year to go wrestle, and my whole family would be covered at that time.
You were ahead of your time. You were thinking on your feet for damn sure.
Yeah. Yeah, at that time, very important.
Hey, I want to cover your first world championship. December 10th, 1975, Jack Briscoe. Right. Now, there's a decision process going on with the commissions, and in particular the NWA commissions, NWA belt. Tell us a little bit about that process, because, it wasn't just like, someone just says, hey, it'd be great if Terry Funk was a champion. Take us through that process.
I think it was at the most right around 30 territories. And then you had a board of directors. That's how the champion was determined, was by the board of directors.
Right.
And it was that was back then in that 70s era. And Sam Mushnick was the president, and then Sam stepped down, and Fritz became the president. And at that time, Jack decided, Jack had been hitting that road every day and everything, and it just wore him out, and it did. That's the way it was, because like myself, I did 310 days out of 365, but that's a lot, and it's a lot of going. And I think I'm sure there's some guys in the WWE's probably hitting close to that themselves, right now. I don't know. But 310 was a lot of doggone shots, But anyhow, as Briscoe went ahead and he the championship wore him out. It wore them all out over a period of years. And he was ready to get out from underneath it. And so who the two finalists were me and Harley. And there was a tie vote on it. And Fritz Von Erich went ahead and this is a true story. And my brother and Harley were great friends at that time, And Harley came up through the School of Hard Knocks.
Absolutely.
You know that? Absolutely did. And as great of a boy and as smart of a guy as I've ever come across. But it came down to the voting, and there were six members, I believe it was, and Fritz, if it came down to a tie, he is going to make the deciding vote. Well, it went 3-3. So then it left all of the pressure on to Fritz, and he said, I'd like to have any more comments. And my brother said, my brother has a college education. And because they wanted to represent people like, like they're somebody, don't misunderstand me, I still don't. But anyhow, what happened at that time is that that was the determining factor, because Fritz wanted somebody with a college education.
Mm.
And that's why I was picked over Harley. And I don't think Harley and my brother have talked since then.
Boy, I'll tell you what, I did not know
that. And I'll tell you what, is I love them both.
Absolutely.
And I really do. I love them both. They're both great guys. And that was really, it was a tough deal for me. It's just that, was I worth the trouble to go ahead, or worth the friendship, or
well, you've been between a rock and a hard place, but if push comes to shove, I'd rather have the belt than not have it. I mean, if I'm in a selection process and my person I'm up against is Harley Race. Well, I would rather have it than Harley. But the responsibilities that go with that, Terry, you talked about your travels on the road. And the world champion is a lot different than the other guys. I mean, everybody's beaten down the road. It is a grind. It's physical. It's mental. Stressful for everybody. But that world champion, many times he's traveling by himself. I mean, because he's going to be in different gigs, booked in different places. One of the things that I read that you used to do when you were passing through Dallas, would you somebody smarten you up to just getting on the tram, which circled the airport, and instead of checking into a hotel room, you would get on the tram and get you, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours of sleep.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We'd sleep on the tram all the time.
That's a pretty thrifty way to save a buck. But let's talk about the travel on the road, because as tough as the travel schedule was as the NWA champion, some years later, you would go to the WWF, and you said the travel there was tougher than being the NWA champion a decade earlier. So the road, it seems to you, in your mind, it was the road that brought on the grind, the drugs, and the alcohol.
I think it wasn't necessarily the small whenever we were had all of the promotions. I think that we had less drugs then, and the reason why, and it's a different era, a different time, of course it is, you know. But as we would drive as far as we could to a town and back.
Right.
That's as far as you went, you know, and you were at home with your family every night. You know, or close to every night. You'd have it one or two nights out sometimes, but, you know, in a week's time or 2 weeks' time. But basically, you were in a territory where you drove. And that was that territory, though, what was so wonderful about that is because you had a schoolroom there. And the schoolroom was whenever you'd get into the car. And whenever you got into the car, whenever you're just starting out, you had to get into the back seat. And usually there was not only two of you, but maybe three. And the seat would be pushed all the way back up against you. And you'd listen to the old timers, and you'd love every minute of it, though. You know, it was a great education. The road was a great education to the business. Now, where do you get educated? All right, let's all go to Chicago tonight. Well, I'll catch this flight. I'll catch that flight. You catch this flight. You're not really together. You're not in that confined atmosphere of a couple of old guys going ahead and talking bullshit to you. And serious bullshit, too. You know, that doesn't happen anymore, you know. I mean, but I thought it was a great thing through all of those years. And listen, as I understand today how they have to do it, and they're doing a great job. I'm telling you, I watch those boys, and I'll tell you what, they have got better athletes than what we have. And I'm sincere about that, you know.
But with being on the road, Terry, with being on the road and always trying to occupy time, inevitably there seems to be, or was, at least when I was around, a lot of booze and a lot of drugs. Is that exclusive to being on the road, or does that just go with the entertainment business or the sport of professional wrestling?
I think it definitely, that's a tough one. You know, the way you put that, I never have really thought about it that much. You know, it was booze when it was booze, you know, and it's the turning loose of them and with the drugs, you know, is a funny thing, you know. People want to be close to the wrestlers, you know, and they will provide them with drugs, they will provide them with booze or whatever, just to be close to them, you know. And the tough part about it is, are those individuals, and listen, I've not always been perfect, but for those individuals to go ahead and be on that road by themselves and to say no. Whereas the football players are not on the road by themselves. They're in a plane with 65 of them or 70 of them or however many they've got going, or 120, and they're all together, but they've got trainers, they've got coaches, they've got overseers to watch them that they don't come in too late, this and that. But who looks after those kids? I mean, the wrestlers.
It's
you know,
funny
we don't
thing.
Have that.
Yeah, but even back in the day, and now, you know, obviously things have changed from when you were in the ring, me in the ring, and now these guys today, they've got trainers and doctors flying around with them. It's a whole different system when you and I were around, kind of back in the caveman days. But yeah, it's great. But man, to me, it was just and the things I did, and I was always more hanging with the drinking crowd. But it was a way to pass time. It was the socializing part of it, just passing the time. But one thing led to another, and then you know here we talk, and it's 2013, and you have you know and over 50 of the guys that have died in the last 10 years or whatever it is. I don't have any statistics on that. But every time, not every time, but the last time one of the boys died, this always, I bring this up because it always bothers me. And I made it out alive. So did you. And everybody should. But someone else died, and someone called me up on the phone, and they said, "God, how long is this going to go on before Vince does something?" And I'm like, it ain't Vince's fault. Every man is responsible for what he puts inside his body, whether it's a pill, a drink, whatever. In my mind, everybody is responsible for taking care of themselves. And on Vince's behalf, he's paid for all these guys to go through rehab, all these detox programs. He's gone over and over, way beyond anything that he should have. But I always get mad at people when they're accusing Vince of being the culprit, because he's not. Do you share that same sentiment with me?
100% so, Steve. It's absolutely absurd to blame someone else, you know. And it's just, you've got too much at stake. You know, you've got the possibility of going ahead in this day and age, the possibility of going ahead and having not just a life, but a wonderful life, and having the majority of it in your later years to go ahead and do what you want to.
You get,
if you watch your money and do the right thing, you know.
You got to watch your money, pay your taxes, not blow your money up your nose like so many have done. And certainly, I was never any angel throughout my run. But it's all about, and this kind of goes down this road in your book. It's about accountability and responsibility for your own actions. You gotta live up to your end of the deal. You make your shots, you do your job, you take care of your business, and it's all on your back.
That's exactly right, you know.
Hey, Terry, I've been in the wrestling business, man, not nearly as long as you, and I had
a few years. I'll tell you that.
Well, you know, I did okay. You know, for a little white guy coming from South Texas, but back in the day, your father Dory Senior promoted. He wrestled, and then your father died, and you took over that Amarillo territory, and you, according to your book, I mean, you immerse yourself so much into the business and probably working in the ring, booking, running everything. So much that you totally, you know, built up a wall between yourself and your wife, Vicky, and
absolutely
ended up getting a divorce. 100%. She left you. What were you
That's
doing?
Right.
What was it, just on the road working, wrestling, the promotion aspect of it? What was it that just drove the wedge between y'all's relationship?
You really want to know? I was obsessed with the business, obsessed with it continuing on. And being better than it was before, you know, that my father passed away. My brother and I both were somewhat obsessed with it, you know, and every day we were on the road, every day we were at meetings, you know. We were running probably 18 towns, and, well, let's see, over 15 towns a week. You know,
yeah.
And that's a lot of towns, and we're running to them and wanting to prove to the country and to the, you know, and for our father, you know, is to continue on with the business and keep it going. And has to do that.
What was the process? You end up, Vicky divorces you. How did you, yeah, how did you Ben, get it, end up getting back together?
Ben, well, as, I was, this is honest God truth. We were only separated about 18 months, you know. We were totally divorced for about 18 months. And, we got back together whenever, she went ahead and I asked her, and we went through the process back and forth, from absolutely a war to just a semi-battle to then to understanding that we still loved each other, you know. And at that time, I was champion. And that's whenever I was champion for I forget how many months. It was about a year and a half or something like that. But anyhow, as I went ahead and she said she wanted to get back together, and I said, okay, I'm getting rid of this belt immediately. And that's what I did, you know, is got rid of the darn thing. And
did that lift a big weight off your back when you got rid of that belt and you were able to spend more time at home?
I loved every minute whenever I got home with my two children at that time. You know, they were young. I was blessed to have the opportunity to get back with my wife, you know, and we're still together after, I guess, we don't even count that. We just call it time out, you know. Took a few months time out there, you know, and finally got back together. But been, all except for those months, been married now for, I think, 47 years or something like that.
You know, before we get out of this, you know, the road is
funny.
Did
a lot of stupid things along the way, too. You know, I think we all are.
Well, I know, but you know, the thing about it is, and I tell everybody, I mean, this is from my standpoint, or how I always looked at the road. When you get on the road, you love it. You're hanging out with the guys. You're working in the ring. You get that adrenaline rush, and you go down to the next town. And then you've been on the road long enough, you're ready to take your ass home. But then when you get home, after a day and a half, you're bored. You're ready to get back on the road. Now, you love your family, but you got a chance to see them. But that road keeps calling your name. That road is saying, Steve, get your ass back out there. So, you know, it's that kind of dynamic. And I tell people, you kind of go into zombie mode. You're fully functional. You're aware of everything. But you just go through the paces, and you're drawn to the next town. And then you finally, you know, like when I got out of the business, and I always say that's when I turned back into a civilian. And I finally got the business out of my blood. But it's an addiction, isn't it?
It's not out of your blood.
Well, no, but you know what I'm saying. It's out of my system as far as I'm not addicted to it anymore. The ring is not calling my name.
That's right. That's right. That's the way you want it to be, too. And retired. But nobody, you know, like people ask me about me coming out of retirement so many times. I said, well, if they offer me enough money again, I'll come out again.
But right now, that you're talking dollar signs right there. So right now, if the dollar signs aren't yelling at you, that's one thing. But you don't still hear that voice calling your name, do you?
No, not at all.
Gotcha.
Not at all.
Hey, I want to talk to you. I want to shift gears because there's one thing I certainly want to talk to you about, and that's promos. You were one of the all-time great promos, and I've watched you. Well, that's the truth. I don't ever say anything unless it's a real deal, unless somebody knows I'm joking around. This is a real deal. And some of your promos back in the day, you know, and I watched a lot of them back then, and I watched a bunch of them on YouTube getting ready for this interview. And many times you'd roll in, and it was a pre-tape, and you had 3 to 5 minutes average to talk. And it was to set up an angle or to get a program started. A lot of them were on the fly in front of live television. My question to you is, I mean, I want to talk all about the aspects of promos, but let's just take this situation. You're coming in. It's a pre-tape promo, and you're gonna get involved with someone in a program, and you've got 3 to 5 minutes. What kind of construction phase of this promo did you go through? How far in advance are you thinking of what you're trying to put together and the message that you wanted to convey?
You know, sometimes it was very quick, and sometimes you didn't know about it, and it was just the immediate thing. You know, I want you to talk about this. you know, and you just, you know, and then other times you would have time to prepare, you know, and I don't think, you know, it's who I learned the ability to do a promo from. Who were the, you know, who did I learn from?
Who did you learn from?
My father was exceptionally good. Another good one, Curtis Iakea. Another great one, Boris Malenko. These guys were wonderful. You know, Mark Lewin, he was great, but he wasn't near as great as those other guys that I mentioned right there. You know, and they had the ability to, you know, to take a minute, you know, or take 2.5 minutes, and it's all about putting an ass every 18 inches. That's what it's about. And they could actually talk them into the arena. You know, Curtis was one of the best of all. Malenko was one of the best of all. I wish that guys would have some access to Boris Malenko's promos whenever he was alive. I learned from him. I would go to the Florida television studio where we shot the promos, you know, and I would walk into there and there would be Boris Malenko, you know, and Boris Malenko, everybody wondered what he was doing. He'd have a little piece of paper there. He'd be looking at that thing, marching back and forth, and thinking and thinking and thinking and looking at it and thinking. And he would go out there, and he'd make the most marvelous promo that you've ever heard in your life. It would just captivate you. They could talk people into the seats.
Mm-hmm.
Boris Malenko, King Curtis Iakea, the same way, you know. But Malenko thought about him more than other people did. Curtis, it was a natural gift to him. At one time in my life, it was a natural gift to me. You know, but it comes over a period of time. You just don't start going out there and start talking on television immediately and coming up with these wonderful things. It takes time, and the more you do it, and the more you do it each week. In other words, the more promos that you make,
right,
and the more you do over a period of time, the better you get.
But to me, what always was the most important thing of a promo to me, you know, content, pacing, was conviction. You better believe that motherfucker that you're saying, and if you believe it, you can, and it all depends on a lot of things, but you have to have the conviction in order to sell tickets. You can go out there and flap your gums a million miles an hour or talk as slow as you want, but if someone looks in your eyes and they know that you don't mean that, that it's not coming from your hearts, it's not coming from your guts, and you don't feel it, it's going to be a long day at the office when it comes time to selling some tickets.
I agree with you, but that's what it's about, is taking that time and making use of it. And that's how that's the difference between your wrestlers and your great ones. If they can do it all, they have to be able to do the promos, they have to be able to do it in the ring, they have to be able to do it all, you know. I truly love doing promos through the years, you know, but I was always believed in being on the fringe. That was very important to me, and sometimes it was taken the wrong way.
Right.
And what I mean by being on the fringe is hitting home with people, you know.
Kind of like, yeah,
would say,
bordering on a shoot.
Yeah, bordering on a shoot, bordering on something that they know, you know, that the fans know, hey, he does not like what he's saying. This is not just normal. He doesn't like it, and the guy doesn't like it, but he has to address it, you know, and I think that really is a defining point in promos, you know. I think you have to be on the fringe. I think you have to be right on the edge, and that edge can sometimes, and I had it happen to me through the years, don't want to say with who, but several guys, you know, they go ahead and they'd actually get PO'd at me because of what I said on the promo.
There's a couple, you know, of those guys in the book. But, you know, in delivering that knife-edge promo, you know, there is those creative spots for the response, and it's up to the recipient of that promo to find that opening and, boom, dagger right back to further the box office draw of that match, correct?
Correct. You're 100%. You've got it. That's it.
There's no use in getting mad about it. Now, don't get me wrong. If someone just does a total shoot and it exposes something you didn't want exposed, well, that's the wrong kind of promo. But I'm talking like you almost, straight up, kind of on a shoot side, but still in the vein of trying to draw money. And we both know the difference. But it's up to that other side to say, oh, all right, motherfucker. Well, I got this for you. And that's where the good magic starts happening.
That's when the magic starts happening, and he damn sure does. And I don't care what he says about me at that time, because it's putting an ass every 18 inches.
Hey, drawing great money, and you work with so many guys and so many classic matches, but just because I was on YouTube, and back in those NWA days, and you and Ric Flair and Dusty worked so much together, and Dusty and Rick had so many matches, and you got a chance to work with both of them. So when you got in the ring with each guy, and you're all the same level, but what's the difference between working with them? Now, obviously, I know that Dusty was a bigger guy, and the mechanics of the match was different, but what was the difference just between being in the ring with Ric Flair and being in the ring with Dusty Rhodes? You got three Hall of Famers, and you're working against both of them. So what was it like with each guy?
You know, is both of them had charisma out the ass.
Yes.
That's what you want. And you can't get any better than those two when it comes to charisma. And Dusty is totally different. Rick did it through, he did it through hard work and the American dream. I don't know exactly how he did that.
Right.
But he did it through talking. He did it through his promos. There's a guy that I didn't even mention about his promos. Was the greatest promo maker in the country. He didn't have to do real well in the ring, but Dusty could do well, and he did do well. You know, as where Dusty came from? He came from right here, Amarillo, Texas.
Yep.
He actually came from Austin, but played football at West Texas State. You know, played baseball here too. Pretty damn good athlete. A little nuts, but he's a pretty good athlete.
Hey, you know,
how could you have it any better than to have Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes, you know?
Oh, I know.
Courtesy of Kea. Ted's daddy was one of the great ones.
You put over Mike DiBiase a lot
DiBiase
in the book.
Mike put him over all day long.
You said he really took you under his wing and helped you out a lot with your work and advice.
Yes, he did, and good advice, the right advice, and I rode down the road with him. Anytime that I had a possibility of getting in his car, I got into it, Teddy watched him grow up right here, and brought him into the school here, West Texas State. He's playing football out, high school football in Arizona, got him a scholarship here. Then Dick Murdoch got a hold of him after about a second year. And went ahead and took him to Louisiana. God damn, Dick should have never done that. should have let Teddy get his education.
But Teddy was always one of my favorite workers, and Iron Mike was a little bit ahead of my time, so I didn't get a chance to hear more. No, but that's all I heard was great stuff about Iron Mike.
The best. Also was a great amateur, two or three times. National champion.
Hey, I've been saying all these good things to you and all these good things about you because they're all true. But I'm about to cuss you like a dog. I'm not going to cuss you. Here's a question. This is straight up. Did you guys invent the triangle match in ECW, which turned into the triple threat match in WWE?
Hell, I invented all of those.
I know. That's what I'm mad about. I hate it. If there's one thing I can't stand, it's a triple threat match. And I read in your book that you invented the son of a bitch.
Yeah. What about the ladder matches?
Oh, I had a ladder match one time with Vince and Shane, and we were using like those little 3-foot ladders because I'm damn near crippled. It was the most embarrassing pay-per-view I've ever been in. You know, the triple threats, Terry. Now, y'all turned those into a fine art. And there's so many different ways to buy the creative time that you need so that you can always kind of, you know, get rid of the third wheel and two guys can work and then that other guy rotates in. You know how you go, but it's just so much going on there. And I read that one match that it was, it was you, Shane, and Sabu, and y'all pretty much working on a fishbone and called it all in the ring.
That was the first one.
Yeah,
that
and you just basically called it in a ring and maybe had a fishbone for a map. And it turned out magic. But, you know, some of those, if they're not detailed, and that's the way I hate to work with too many details that you have to ingrain in your memory. And, you know, from back in the day when you just called everything in a ring and
that's
getting rid of that other guy.
That's all we ever did.
They're a pain in the ass, Terry. I'm not happy about the triangle match, brother.
You still aren't happy about it.
I'm not even in the goddamn business anymore. Okay, we went back to ECW. I've also got this written down right here. I had to get, you know, I've seen some of the stuff where your wife and your daughters have seen you work and, you know, all through the days, and then all of a sudden you're doing all the hardcore stuff. What are they thinking when they're watching you do this crazy stuff? Because, I mean, I know it's all calculated risk. You know what you're doing. You're a brave son of a bitch. Put yourself in their shoes. What are they thinking?
They bawled a lot at the matches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's
hard to watch a loved one do that.
Something that my wife, you know, I didn't want them doing that, but I, you know, they watched and they believed, you know, and never did smarten them up until they were about 15, 16, you know, and smarten them up then, you know, and they really appreciated the business, you know, and that I just kind of followed the same road my father did. You know, it's the way he smartened me up, you know, as I was afraid, you know, I was smart, but I was afraid to say anything, like my face slapped or something.
Yeah, you know, the hardcore stuff there in ECW, and then the stuff I read about you and Mick Foley doing over in Japan, barbed wire, explosions, thumbtacks, total brutality. I mean, you guys are literally, you're working, but you're taking a shit pile of punishment just from the elements designed into that thing. You're getting burned, and then you get on a flight after you patched yourself up or maybe went and saw a doctor, second, third degree burns. Man.
Well, you know, Steve is, at the time, was willing to do it because at the time I was making exceptional money over there.
Right, gotcha.
And there were, at the time, we had no TV in that group that was there. It was just an independent group. But at that time, we drew 44,000 people.
God damn.
So that wasn't a bad deal, you know, and I didn't get paid enough, but I got paid a lot. And what I could do at the time was go over there for maybe four tours of 3 weeks apiece, you know, 12 weeks in a year, 16 weeks in a year, and make great money and come back home and, you know, just kind of the reverse wetback. You know, like those Mexicans come up here and go to work and go back home. Live good. I was going to Japan, going to work, coming back home and having a lot of time off. You know, and I'll tell you what, you guys were hitting the pavement every day up there in New York. I mean, you guys bust your ass for your money. And I know because I'd been there before, you know, and it's a rough rough road to hoe up there, and it's a lot of work.
You
but
know,
I was just trying to figure out again, you know, the easiest way to support my family well and make it to where life's fun, you know. Keep it fun. Try to at least, you know.
You got to keep it fun, and it's a grind, and, you know,
it is a grind.
But once you get into business, you remember there used to be that old saying. There used to be this old saying, and I heard this when I was in USWA. It was always this one. You get in the business to get out of the business. Meaning, you know, you go in, make a bunch of money, and then get out while you're still sane and you have your health. Bullshit. That doesn't happen. No one wants to get out of the goddamn business. But, you know, it's a love for the...
And it's really... and we all say, we want more. It's not we want more. We want more. Yeah, we want more. Not money. We want to work more.
You know, you can't.
Get in the ring again.
But you know what, Terry? And I think we're going to be on the same page with this. You're doing it because it's your job, and you love your job, and you're lucky to be doing it because it don't feel like a job, man. I mean, anytime you can go out there and entertain a mass of people, regardless of the number, and have that adrenaline rush, and there's a guy across the ring with you and a referee in there working that thing and telling that story, it is an absolute ball. But
it's the greatest. It's wonderful.
But you love it's what wonderful. You're able to take, the ride that you're able to take those people on, and the story that they get involved in and live vicariously through the angles and everything. They mean everything to the business because it's money, but it's the fans too. And I know that you love your fans, and you've always been, every time I've ever seen you, humble as hell, and I've never seen you with a big head, but you have such a relationship with your fans. You mentioned John over there in Philly. Remember John in ECW days?
Absolutely, yeah. And I still remember John.
And he was the guy with the white dog, right?
You bet he was.
Man,
guy in a wheelchair.
Always there at the matches. He was just the biggest fan in the world. Had that beautiful white dog. And then you talk about old Mo always giving you rides in Philly. I remember Mo.
she called yesterday.
Oh, man. I can't remember what she was driving back in the day. But, man, she was so helpful. It was a shuttle system, taking guys back and forth to the airport. I know they weren't making any money, but I know you enjoy, I guess the point I'm trying to make, you enjoy your relationship with the fans.
I really do. And I really appreciate them for, I'm the one guy that knows that, hey, the only reason I'm living the way I'm living right now is because of the fans. And do I have time for them? And yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. Whenever I'm a good guy, by golly, I got time for them. I don't care where it is. They are the reason that I am sitting here looking out this window right now at this water and this lake. It's beautiful, and able to go ahead and be in a rocking chair and rock back and let a few farts. And it's not a bad life, is it? Well, the reason I'm living that is because of the Mo's of this world and the fans of this world.
The book. And I suggest that everybody who's a wrestling fan go get this book. It's been out since 2005. I just read it. It's called Terry Funk, More Than Just Hardcore. It's just the history of the business, the passion of the business, and what goes on the road, and a little bit of the insight without exposing everything and David Copperfield showing you his magic tricks. It's a great explanation into the inner workings of the business. And before I say goodbye, Terry, with everything said and we've talked about today, I'd love to have you on again, but is there anything you regret doing your entire time in the business? Jumping off something you shouldn't have, blown something up, or you just leave it all as it was?
I would leave everything as it was. I wish that I would have had more time with my father. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things, regret, don't regret a thing. I think one time Cactus and I were wrestling you. I think it wasn't somebody else. Had the opportunity in the ring to be in the ring with you, and the only thing that I regret is that we didn't get to beat you guys.
you son of a bitch.
I would have loved to beat you one time, Steve Austin. Then I would have really bragged about you. I'd have said that you were the best. You were better than Luthez.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
If I would have gotten to go over you one time.
Throughout the book, you keep going back, and it was all about spending more time with your family. You went down a hell of a damn road. You got divorced from your high school sweetheart. You got back with her. You talk about watching your two daughters grow up and how much you valued that time. And I'm at that same place right now. I never won Father of the Year. I was always gone, and I'm working my ass off, and I could have done a lot better. But now I'm out of that ring. I love being with my wife and my dogs. I'm enjoying life. It sounds like you are too. I want to say thank you very much for being on the show, and I wish you nothing but the best.
Had a great time with you, Steve.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
With the holidays coming up, we'd like to offer you a little something special. And all we're asking in return is a few moments of your time to help support a great sponsor of this podcast. We ask that you complete a short survey, because your opinion matters to us and our sponsors. It'll only take a couple minutes. And if you're one of the first people to do it, we'll give you a reward in return. Just go to podcastopinions.com, and everything will be right there for you. That's podcastopinions.com. The first 150 people who complete the survey will get a $10 gift card to Amazon.com. All of our shows are supported by advertisers, so filling this out will really help us. Please go to podcastopinions.com, and as always, thank you for supporting the show.